Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 21st, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is David Messenbring, continuing his series on maritime ministry. Today's session is number 8 and is entitled Mission Promise, Africa's Unclaimed Gift to Us. Let's listen in.
My name is David Messenbring, and this session that we're going to do tonight, my last after 2 weeks of teaching here, is called, and my favorite, by the way, is called Mission Promise, Unclaimed Gifts That Africa Offers Us. And really, what it's about, the underlying purpose that it's about, has to do with style of doing Christian mission. And I'm going to develop a thesis tonight that I think the mission God calls us to is larger than the one we've been carrying out. That the understanding of mission that I grew up with in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and I've sort of covered them all, LCA and ALC and AELC and LCMS, and I'm now an ELCA pastor, married to an Episcopalian and worked a lot for the Anglicans. The mission style or concept that I grew up with was that the gospel, as I understand it, is a precious gift which I'm called to share with other people. And I understood that to mean going out and giving people the gospel just as I understand it. I'm going to argue tonight that the mission God calls us to is larger than that. That it involves actually an encounter that is mutually transforming. And more than just rhetoric, I'm going to try and be very practically specific about how we go about that. The way I'm going to get there is by sharing with you some of my own personal experience. I didn't learn this in seminary or reading books or listening to speakers. I learned it by going out and working as a missionary in South Africa, where I spent 2 years in 1976 and 77. And at the end of that time, I was formally ordained by one of the churches that I'm going to tell you about tonight, and sent home to go back home and convert my own people. They kind of said, go back home and share with the people in the churches of your country what you've learned from us. Commissioning to ministry that I've always taken seriously, although I had a hard time convincing anybody else to take it seriously for a while. At least the sponsoring churches that had sent me out to South Africa in the first place weren't really prepared to receive me back with a mission here. I shouldn't be too hard on them. They didn't obstruct me in any event. And I was convinced that I had the mission, and in a variety of creative ways, usually self-supporting or trying to find ways of doing what I thought I was called to do and making it pay at the same time, I've pursued that. And as I was saying earlier, now do port chaplaincy as a way of working on our worldview, putting Christians from our churches in the area where I live together with people who come through on the ships, many of whom are Christians and read their Bibles a lot more faithfully than we do. So the way I'm going to get at my argument is to share with you what happened to me when I went to South Africa as a missionary. I went, thanks to Desmond Tutu, to teach in an Anglican seminary in South Africa. But I wasn't very happy in that seminary, for reasons we don't need to go into. And I began, thanks to Bears Now Day, to go outside of the seminary and look for contact with African Christians rather than Western Christians. African Christianity throughout the continent, and especially in South Africa, not in every country, interestingly enough, but in most countries of Africa, divides usually right down the middle into two completely different styles of the church. On the one side, you have what are called historical, but actually these churches have a history too, or traditional churches. I'm kind of uncomfortable. I haven't found a name I really like using for them. So I usually call them historical or traditional. These are the churches that you and I know. the Lutherans, the Catholics, the Anglicans, lots of chairs over here if you run out there. Roman Catholics, Methodists, Baptists, those churches which have their historical roots in Europe or North America, and who sent missionaries out to Africa to duplicate themselves. And that's really the key word for the process of what happens. And for the understanding, the style of mission. It's that sense of mission that I grew up with. Well, that I was explaining a little bit earlier, that we're called to go out and give the gospel or share the gospel with other people exactly as we understand it. And the result is a tendency to duplicate our churches. I mean, the Lutheran Church in Tanzania might not have the LBW, but I assure you that if you went and worshiped there, you would recognize a lot of the church. And it begins with a missionary movement that didn't really understand or see or sense the distinction between our faith and our culture. Now that's no great shame on those missionaries, I guess, because that problem of distinguishing faith and culture is one that we've been struggling with for a long time. Lots of chairs over here. Just feel free. I'm glad you're here. We've been struggling with that ever since the Jerusalem Council. Huh? We can read in the book of Acts about the tensions in the early church between the Jewish Christians who felt that that to become a Christian, Gentiles really should first learn to keep the Jewish dietary laws and customs, and then they could add Christianity, the Christian, then they could be baptized. And Paul, of course, the first great missionary of the church, who goes out and baptizes people, whether they eat pork or not. That's an example of this tension between faith and culture, which is as old as our Christian faith itself. And the missionaries who went to Africa in the 18th, 19th centuries were no different. For example, we think of Africa today as having this tremendous musical tradition, and we've kind of loosened up and gotten excited about that, especially here in the village. But missionaries who went to Africa were very threatened by drums. I can assure you that the first missionaries who went to Africa would have been scandalized by the kind of worship we do in the village center over here. They taught Africans that God likes an organ best. If you can't get an organ in your church, a piano will do. If you don't have an organ or a piano, then just sing for all you're worth, but never, ever bring a drum into a Christian worship service. And less than 20 years ago, in an Anglican seminary in South Africa, I had pretty heated arguments with my students about whether or not it was appropriate to use drums in a Christian worship service, they being convinced absolutely that it was not. There's an example of confusing, in modern times, our faith and our culture. Another example, since I'm a Lutheran, I'll pick on the Lutherans here, and confess to you that it was official mission policy, whether working among Native Americans in Michigan or Africans, it was official mission policy of one of the major Lutheran churches in our country not so long ago, not to offer instruction that would lead to baptism until people first learn the only language that God understands. And that's German, for those of you who didn't grow up in the church of my grandmother. It's German. God likes German best. She got German services till the day she died, right here in Minnesota. That's true. Our missionaries would taught people German first, and once they learned German, they could get instruction that would lead to baptism. That's less than 100 years ago. And that's how the church got started. Theological training is another example. In duplicating our churches in Africa, train clergy the same way that it happens here. You know, we build a residential seminary, take people out of their community, put them into a little ivory tower that looked a lot like Europe, and certainly the traditions and the habits. The seminary was tried to be, as much as they could, a carbon copy of the seminaries that those who taught in that seminary remembered from North America or Europe. And people got a heavy intellectual, Western, cultural, intellectual understanding of the Christian faith. And those who were viewed by their white teachers as being the most promising might get sent to Europe or North America for additional training in our Western institutions and then brought back to teach in that seminary or begin serving as ministers. Not a lot of orientation about what is Africa. Now, it's changing today, but I'm talking about the roots of our how the churches got born. And that's not a heritage which is overnight changed. Today, increasingly and to varying degrees in different parts of Africa, Lutherans, for example, would recognize the need to indigenize their faith more. But it's a struggle. And you got those churches full of people who have been singing German Lutheran hymns for a long time and don't want to start singing this modern stuff. It's the same phenomenon that we got here. People are basically the same everywhere. Okay, those are the historic or traditional churches. I'm not going to say much about them tonight because we know them. And because I'm much more excited about and interested in these independent churches. I taught on this side of a very rigid line that people hardly ever cross in South Africa or some other countries. I should say a word about the fact that in some countries this doesn't exist. For example, if your only experience of Africa has been Namibia, for example, or Tanzania, you may really argue with me about the fact that I say half of Africa's Christians are from these churches. Because in Namibia and Tanzania, you don't really see much of this at all. In South Africa, you can't go to South Africa and not see these people walking the streets on Sunday morning in their brilliant uniforms and gowns. Why in some places and not in others? One theory is that it has to do with how soon the flow of Western missionaries dried up. And in Tanzania and Namibia, it dried up fairly early. Those were German colonies, and at a fairly early stage, relatively early stage, Germany stopped sending out lots of missionaries. And so the result was that the local church was given the opportunity to put its own leadership in place at a much earlier stage, say, than in neighboring South Africa. Or Tanzania's neighbor would be Kenya. Kenya is full of independent churches and a lot of whites. They've been there and they were very comfortable that they stayed there for a long time, much longer than they stayed in Tanzania. South Africa, of course, is full of a lot of whites. Where you had a continuing European or Western Northern, I like to divide the world into the North and the South, where you had a continuing Northern presence, you had less cultural flexibility in the church, with the result that the independent churches tended to be born. Where the flow of missionaries stopped a little quicker, blacks became leaders of those churches, and the earlier they became leaders of those churches, the earlier African culture started to show up as acceptable in those churches, and the less need there was for these churches to be born. So you don't find these independent or indigenous churches all over the continent, but where you find them, you find a lot of them. Now, if this is Western Christianity, duplicated in Africa here, this is a culturally African expression of the faith. Drums are very acceptable. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find one of these churches that doesn't use the drum. Now, name-wise, I call them independent, or now more and more in a place like South Africa, at least, they tend to be called African indigenous churches. Let's remember that Christianity is older in Africa than it is in Europe or North America. You remember the story of the baptism of the Ethiopian. No? And the Christianity in Ethiopia predates Christianity in Europe or Africa. Christianity, of course, was born in the Middle East. And about the same time it went to Greece and Rome, it went to Ethiopia. And there are Christians in Africa who trace their Christian history right back that far. So these churches like to call themselves African indigenous churches. By that, they don't all claim a historic relationship to the Ethiopian eunuch, but they do. They still like the name indigenous because of the way in which they do affirm their traditional African culture. They're also considered independent because of the way most of them were born, as a movement of independency out of the historical churches. Say more about that in just a second. First, I need to confess that after 2 years of working on both sides of the line and trying to get to know Christians in both places, I've worked a lot more. Since those 2 years in South Africa, I've worked a lot more in a lot of other parts of Africa and did a forum on Saturday night called The Lively Church, Diverse Models from Africa. And there you can look at that to get a sense of some of the different parts of Africa and the different kinds of churches that exist there. But my experience of the independent churches, which is tougher to come by, is really confined to those 2 years in South Africa. And really all I learned during those 2 years is how much I don't know about them. Which puts me ahead of my Anglican students at the seminary and most of our sister Lutherans or Methodists or whatever you happen to be, who are pretty sure that they know that these people are not Christian. And I should confess to you that if I was in the room tonight with a bunch of Lutherans from Tanzania, I would get a stiff argument. Well, Tanzania is not a good example because they don't have many of these churches there, but let's say from Kenya or Zambia or Zimbabwe or South Africa, they would argue with me pretty vociferously that these people are not Christians. But you let me introduce them tonight and then see what you would say. Yes, sir.
Do you mean by independent? Would that be independent country by country or church by church, or are they
church by church?
Church by church.
Yep. Maybe we ought to say a word. One more note to make there. The other thing to keep in mind, that I'm not an expert, although I've studied it, I've read about it, I've experienced it, and that's the key. And that's what you're not going to get tonight. You're not going to get an experience of these churches. I didn't bring with me this time, I sometimes just turn on a tape of their chanting and use it in the background as I talk about them. Just to give you a feel or a reminder that they're not here. You have to worship with these Christians to begin to understand them. Their style of worship is so different. Their love of God is so all-encompassing of their life. Don't confuse them with me. I'm just reflecting a little bit of my experience. But if you could meet them, you would get a much fuller appreciation. You've got to experience them to know them, and we're not going to experience them tonight. But I am going to share with you some of what I learned from them. And maybe one place to start is just to talk a little bit about how they got started. And there are thousands of these churches. In South Africa alone, it's estimated that 20 years ago, there were 4,000 of them. 4,000 denominations, not people, denominations of these churches. So they're small groups, and we're not going to look at the history of all of them, but a very typical history of how they got started I can share with you, and that comes from the Methodist Church. Let's pick on the, hope there aren't any Methodists here. I'm going to pick on the Lutherans a little already. It's a true story. In South Africa, there was a Methodist missionary who worked hard to establish the Methodist Church in this region of the country. Spent 30 years career as a missionary there, cultivating native leadership who would be recruited, would be given theological training locally. Some of the best and brightest were sent overseas to get additional training. They came back home. They worked under his supervision. Methodists organized themselves in a polity, which refers to supervisors. Well, the day comes that the missionary dies, and the church has to replace him with a new supervisor. And in this particular case, instead of taking advantage of some of the local leadership that this missionary had worked so hard to cultivate, they brought out a 21-year-old graduate of the seminary from England, straight, fresh from seminary, no parish experience in Europe, and certainly no experience of Africa, and made him the supervisor. Now, why does that make sense? Because if your effort is to duplicate the faith as we understand it, then who better to do that than a fresh, young seminary graduate who's got the latest training and knows the most about what theologians think right now? In this particular situation, it was a disaster. The guy made all kinds of mistakes that the local black Methodist pastors just couldn't take, and really eventually came to the conclusion that remaining within this church structure was hindering their ability to spread the gospel. That the kinds of decisions that were being made were actually turning people off to the church so fast that what they had to do was leave the Methodist church and form their own church structure, their own denomination, and thus became an African independent church. That case happened about 1890. And in the late 1800s and continuing through this century, this kind of phenomenon has happened all over the place. And then, of course, churches start splitting among themselves because they tend to be organized around a strong, charismatic leader. That kind of authoritarian or very strong leader-centered movement tends to spawn a lot of schism, because you get another leader who comes up from that church, and eventually he's going to be more comfortable going off on his own and forming his own church. Now, that's both a strength and a weakness of these churches. It's a weakness because the more we split up, the less we learn from each other. It's a strength because it keeps the communities small. And I've seen situations where churches will intentionally, not by virtue of any hostile split, but just when they get to be too large, and large is more than 30, typically, for an AIC congregation. I can never decide whether it's independent or indigenous, so they both use the same acronym, AIC. They would, when they get much larger than 30, they'd split, in order to keep that strong sense of community. And it is a characteristic of these churches that I can share. With 4,000 denominations, let me assure you, they run the map in terms of differences from one another. And in a little few minutes tonight, all we can do is, all I want to do, need to do really, is focus on some of the commonalities that you find among them. And certainly style of community is one, or emphasis on community. That small size, the intense mutual support that they offer each other. It's unthinkable in an indigenous church congregation that you would have a funeral without the whole congregation being present. I mean, it's just unthinkable, because that's your family. If one member of the congregation experience some kind of traumatic economic disaster, the whole congregation would chip in and rescue that person, and I might even go deep into my life savings to do it, knowing full well that when I have a need, the congregation will support me as well. It's a tight-knit, intense sense of community. They thrive often in the urban areas of Africa, and one theory for this is that when people leave the rural areas, where you have such a strong sense of community and you know your neighbors, and you come into the urban area and you're so disoriented by the different values and the sense of anonymity that one experiences from that kind of a transition, that you may find yourself again in an AIC congregation, find that lost sense of strong community. It's interesting that an independent church leader would only count as, you ask him or her how many members you got in your congregation, and he or she'll tell you how many people were in church last Sunday. They only count the ones that show up. Now, people do show up, but they don't count. They couldn't conceive of congregations like ours where we struggle to get 50% of our membership in church on Sunday morning. So one characteristic feature of these churches all over the continent would be emphasis on community. A second one would be worship. They know how to worship. Actually, African Christians in general know how to worship. I talked on Saturday night about not getting bored in a 5 or 6 hour Anglican service in Ghana. And even more so in these churches. You can't get bored. They chant and sing and dance and clap. I was reminded at Vespers a couple of nights ago when we did this rapid clapping. That comes straight, there was an African song, and that comes straight out of the independent churches. I said so to Tom Witt afterwards, and he didn't argue with me. That the historical churches might clap a little slower, but that kind of clapping, that comes from the independent churches, and they would mix that with chanting. And the music is kind of in between everything else. So you would begin, I remember churches where the worship leader would tell the children to start singing. And the children would actually march around the compound or even the community, beating drums and just singing. And that's the call to worship. That's when people put away their laundry or whatever it is they're doing and get ready and make their way one by one to church. And over the next 30 or 45 or 60 minutes, people slowly gather and join the music. After people had marched around the community for a while, they would go into the space where they're going to worship. If they have a church building, go into the building and start singing there. And the worship leader kind of keeps one ear cocked toward the church and hears the volume and the enthusiasm growing. And when it gets up to a certain level, you know people are ready to begin, and then they would come and join the chanting and the singing and maybe some dancing, depending on the church, for a while. At one point, the leader might put her hand up and open with a prayer. Typically, in an independent church situation, there might be one prayer said by the leader, but then very quickly, when people pray, everybody gets on their knees and prays their own prayer out loud to themselves. Now, to an outsider, it sounds like a lot of babbling, but actually you worship in that kind of a setting, and you hear what your neighbors are praying for and put it in your own words and pray for it too. It can be a very meaningful way to pray. But as soon as that prayer's over, you're chanting again. And it might go on 5 minutes or 15, or it might go an hour. And then the leader puts his hand up again, then reads from Scripture. And then some chanting. And then starts preaching. And maybe his preaching will be interrupted 3 times by some chanting. And then someone else will preach, and they'll be chanting. And then someone else will preach. If it's an all-night service, everyone will get a chance to preach. I talked last week about a baptism, the most moving baptism I've ever witnessed, which took place in a small round hut, maybe this large in diameter, with a thatched roof, far into the countryside. Started at dusk one evening, went through the whole night. At one point or another in the night, most people napped a little bit, but not long. And was a lot of chanting, drums, some dancing, not too much that night. And in between the chants, virtually everyone had a chance to preach. And what they preached on was instruction for the candidates for baptism. And when first light started to appear, we moved outside and marched down to the river about a mile and a half away from this mountainside, down to the river, gathered in a circle, and did more chant the whole time, beating the drums. Poor neighborhood, you know, had to listen to all these drums. And this is early in the morning, before dawn. Anyway, at dawn, we baptized these three teenagers in the river. And it was one of the most moving baptisms I've ever been part of. Went on all night long, all the instruction. It was tremendous. Worship life in the independent churches is exciting. And people turn out for it. They'll come in Soweto, the suburb of Johannesburg. People will come all night, one or two nights of the week, and then show up for a 5 or 6 hour service on Sunday. Or if they don't go all night, they'll start at 8 o'clock and quit at 3 in the morning and get a few hours sleep and go back to work as maids or whatever in the white households. And thirdly, we got to say something about healing. Africans take seriously the New Testament promise of healing. They make no bones about it. They say it's in the Bible, you know. And don't tell me that we can't have it. It's part of the promise of new life in Christ. And they believe it, and it happens in ways that I can't explain. But to understand it, we might want to digress just for a minute here and talk a little bit about healing in traditional African society. And by the way, I'm grateful for your bold question, because I forgot to say that I welcome it as we go along, and without hearing that, you were brave enough to offer it. So I encourage others of you, if you got a question as we go along, just stick your hand up, and I might not get you immediately, but I will. So let's digress and talk about healing in traditional African society, and then the kind of healing that goes on here might make more sense, be more understandable. If you got sick in traditional Africa, and by the way, lots of Africans are not Muslims nor Christians, but are still follow their traditional ways. So this is still real. And we're blending, you know, the culture of 50 countries, and you take one of those countries like Nigeria, has got 250 languages, and every language has got its own culture. So what I'm about to say is a gross generalization for a continent. But it comes after reading some African scholars on African religiosity. The cosmology, if you will, was God's up here, very hard to get at, very remote. The ancestors are kind of in the middle, and we people are still walking around on Earth. Life is defined as a 7-generation cycle. And typically, traditional Africans can name their ancestors going back a long way. And when they meet, it's not uncommon. I've seen lots of Africans who meet, who start to kind of search their ancestry together. And really what they're looking for is, do we have any remote relations with one another? And because they know their ancestors going so far back and so spread out on that family tree, they more often than not can find some kind of a relationship somewhere, or at least know of each other's clans. So the view would be that we people have a very close relationship with our ancestors, and it's important to follow the customs and the prescribed rituals in order to maintain good relationships with our ancestors, because the ancestors are the ones who kind of mediate for us with God. And for example, as long as you keep the ancestors happy, the ancestors will provide some protection vis-a-vis evil spirits, and if you don't have that protection, your kid's going to get sick. So your kid gets sick, you would go and see the Ekklesia. We could say witch doctor, except I really don't think that name helps us very much. In our own society, I think a word like that conjures up all kinds of stereotypes that are not very honoring. So the language I learned in South Africa is Xhosa. It's the language of Desmond Tutu or Nelson Mandela. It's a click language. Xhosa, Kanyang, Tongu. Ekklesia. The traditional healer in Xhosa society would be called an Ekklesia. And if you got sick, you'd take your whole family, because health is viewed as from a very holistic point of view. So your whole family's got to go along to see the Ekklesia. And you would walk in, not say anything. You'd begin by, the Ekklesia you'd have some greeting or whatever, but you wouldn't talk about why you had come. And the Ekklesia knows you've come because you got a problem. Might be bad luck, it might be a broken leg, but you got a problem. And there's that kind of holistic approach to health that wouldn't distinguish between the physical and the psychological and the spiritual, the way our society would. It would kind of put it all together. So I'd throw the bones and then tell you, well, you came because your third daughter over here has got stomachache or whatever. And if I'm on target in my diagnosis, you know, in my it's not a prediction, in my reading, then you know you're with the right doctor. If actually it's your uncle who's got a back problem, then you might go try another doctor, right? But imagine the problems that mission doctors ran into. Because people would walk into their office and they'd say, "What's your problem?" And people would get up and leave. So this guy doesn't know his business, you know. You're supposed to tell me what my problem is. Now, I have seen that happen. And I wasn't fooled. I've seen it happen with people I was very close to. And I think I told the story last week. I can't explain it, and the point isn't to explain it, not even to convince you of it, just to tell you, to share my experience. I've seen there's something that, there's a lot we don't understand. And in fact, it's the physicists today who are telling us that we got it all wrong with our emphasis on matter and causality, that it isn't quite as neat and simple as we thought. So maybe Africans got a line on something there that we could learn from. Now the hard part isn't telling you what problems brought you here. What led to them. You know, you might say, after the birth of your last son, you know, you neglected to slaughter a sheep, to call your friends and family together, and to have a big feast, and to tip a little beer on the ground in honor of the ancestors, to slaughter that beast, which to give thanks to God and the ancestors for the gift of this new child. You didn't show respect to the powers that be for this blessing that you received, and they're angry, they withdrew your protection, and now you got problems. But it's more difficult than to simply slaughter that sheep at your own compound. Now what you need to do is to bring a goat to my place, because a goat is more expensive than a sheep, and I will slaughter it in a certain prescribed fashion that hopes to placate the anger of your ancestors and put you back in harmony with the ways of the world. That's traditional African society. In the independent churches, you join the congregation that you were healed in. And in the course of a lifetime, you might belong to three different congregations. And if I interviewed you about the movement you made from one to the other, I would probably find that it corresponded to three major health crises in your life. And you might have moved among several congregations and then found healing dramatically in one. And you stay there until some point in the future when you're ill again and not getting well and find your way into another community. That's typically, according to some of the scholars who have researched it, how people will move from one congregation to another. But the point is that people find healing in these churches. And typically there's a kind of power balance within the congregation between the healer, who more often than not is a woman, and the titular authority, the bishop, who is often a man. And the two need each other. In a sexist place like Africa, it's hard for a woman to be the bishop, but women tend to have more of these healing gifts than men do, so the bishop needs the healer, and the healer needs the bishop, and the two kind of work in a delicate balance with one another. I knew and was very close to a woman who just died on Christmas Eve, called Gogo, or Granny, the old lady. And I call her the old lady. That is a compliment, by the way. Any of you are over 45 and think of yourself as old, don't be offended. In traditional African society, to be called an old lady or an old man is a term of great respect. Age is highly respected in Africa. So when I say old lady, please don't be offended. She's a very strong personality and a little unusual in the sense that she had male bishops, but it was very clear to anybody who spent any time in those churches who was running the show. It was her. I loved her very much, and she taught me a lot. She explained to me this business about healing. She had a national reputation around South Africa as a healer. Hardworking woman, very honest, never took credit for the healing that happened. Always insisted that, she said, on my own I can do nothing. But God has, God uses me, God works through me at times to answer the Christian faith of people that come to me in need of healing. But without the faith on the part of these patients, and without God's help, nothing happens. So it isn't me, it's God working through me to answer the faith of the people that come. She explained to me that, and she had a whole bunch of treatments that she would use. She ran a church based out of her compound. It's fascinating. We could talk all night just about what went on that compound and how she came to be called as a leader, the churches that she founded, how she would go about preaching in kind of revival meetings, situations, and people would be healed. She would stay in the community for a while. I mean, we're not talking about healing that just happens like that. We're talking about her work with someone over a period of time. Might be a few days, it might be weeks or months. But people came to her bad off and left restored to life. She said, sometimes when I'm working with someone and they're really not making much progress, I have on occasion, thing I've got to tell you. I said that there's virtually no traffic back and forth across this line. I mean, my Anglican students just insisted that these people had slid back into heathen ways under the guise of Christianity, and they were not really even Christians. The only example of traffic across this line is on the part of black Christians over here, who when they get sick, at night when no one's watching, I saw that. I was staying in her compound once, and she dragged this poor man who was so embarrassed to my room one night. And she said, see, this is what I've been telling you. This guy is a Methodist pastor, and on Sunday mornings he preaches against me. But tonight he's sick, and he's come to me for prayers and treatments and healing. She said, sometimes when people really aren't making much progress, I will tell them, maybe you better bring a goat next week. Now imagine the missionary standing down the street who see this kind of thing. You can understand why they're going to make judgments about the fact that these people have slid back into their heathen ways under the guise of Christianity. But she says, I slaughtered that goat with a difference. For example, in traditional African society, when you slaughter the goat, you would never let a drop of blood fall to the ground, because then the whole ritual is spoiled. The blood is precious, and you collect the blood, and the ancestors would be outraged to see that blood spilled on the ground. She says, I slaughter the goat, and as I'm doing it, I talk to them, as in fact I talk to all of my patients about our faith all the time. And she says, I would collect the blood, and then in one dramatic act, I spill the blood on the ground. And I turn to the patient and I say, you and I have no need for this part of our traditional African custom, because we've been saved by Christ's blood, which paid the price for our sins. Now, to my way of thinking, that's an example of taking a traditional, cultural-bound custom and altering it in such a way that you use it to communicate the Christian message. And I don't have a problem with that. But if I'm a white missionary trying to teach people German and I see this going on down the street, I'm likely to miss the point. Let me share with you how I introduced myself to these churches when I would go into them. I mean, it was in South Africa at that time, and even today, I dare say, there isn't much white visitation of the independent churches because they thrive in the black neighborhoods, and when I was there, it was illegal for whites to go into those neighborhoods. I broke the law just to go into those neighborhoods and visit those churches. And so it was rare to see somebody like me coming into those churches. Sometimes I was expected by the leader, but not by the people. Sometimes I even visited when the leader didn't know I was coming in. But you can pick them out. You walk through the township and you can hear the drums going on inside somebody's home. And you know that if you knock on the door, you know they're going to let you in because that's how that church functions. It's just like walking into any church anywhere, anytime. And if I came in, you know, immediately people would kind of wonder what was going on. And fairly quickly, the worship leader would hold up his hand, acknowledge my presence, and then pass it over to me for a word. And that was sort of a polite way of saying, tell us what in the world you're doing here, you know. And if they had ever seen a white person coming into their churches, it was, you know, it would have been a pretty self-righteous somebody who was coming to tell them that they were on their way to hell and they ought to join the true church. And in an apartheid South Africa, the black church leader would know you can't prevent the white from doing that, so you better let him do it and get it over with and be on his way. And I had a standard way of introducing myself there that I'll share with you right now. I said, when God called me to be a minister to my people, I followed the custom in my country and I went to the university to study. But I went with a clear sense that not all was well within my church, because most of my young friends had left the church, had no interest in participating in the worship life of my churches. They still had an understanding of what they believed about God, but they weren't interested in worshiping. So I went to study and prepare myself for being a minister with this sense of calling to the problem that my church was facing. And in the course of my studies, I learned that there are really two sides to God's message: the message of the Word and the message of the Spirit. Now, sometimes these churches are called spiritual churches. So the understanding of the use of that word spoke loudly to them, and they're Spirit-filled churches. What I didn't say to them, but I will share with you, is that I was coming off of an understanding of the two spheres of our brain. 20 years ago, it was cutting-edge psychology. Now it's much better understood, much more acknowledged. We know that on one, you know, that our brain is in two halves, and that on one side is centered logical, mathematical, reason-type stuff, and on the other side happens the more artistic, musical, aesthetic appreciation, for example. That's a simplistic version of that. But I was thinking of that when I said that there's the message of God's Word, the Logos, and the message of God's Spirit. That's what I learned in my studies. And as I looked at my churches, I thought, our understanding of the Word is strong. My friends still have an understanding of what they believe. But maybe we needed to understand the message of God's Spirit better. And so I looked in the course of my studies for a way in which to, how could I learn more about the message of God's Spirit? And in the course of studying Christianity in Africa, I learned about the existence of the African indigenous churches as a group of Christians who were very strong in their understanding of the message of God's Spirit. And I prayed that someday I might have the opportunity to come and meet those churches and learn from them as part of my preparations. And as you see me standing in front of you today, you know my prayer has been answered. Now, was curious. Every time, in varying ways, I introduced myself that way, something happened that was the envy of Christians over here. Christians over here are always trying to get at the independent churches to teach them the Word, you know, to educate them. These church leaders are trained in seminaries. These church leaders are self-supporting priests for the most part, and they have no access to seminaries. I mean, the seminaries that exist in Africa are the ones we've built for our sister churches. These church leaders are trained in a practical manner, very highly. I mean, you don't become a church leader here until you have grown up in a community and been tested in a variety of roles, and the whole community says, yes, we see you as a leader. None of this business where some ambitious high school graduate decides he wants to go to seminary because the priest is living in a house with running water, and he thinks that'd be a good idea, and he's a bright student, and he can get admitted to a seminary, studies apart from life in the congregation. The seminarians that we were sending for ordination did no practical internships. They were ordained and then sent out to work under the supervision of another priest. I mean, if they were a good student, they got through. They didn't have to be a good leader, a natural leader in community. But they had to understand the word. And so people here are always trying to get at the independent churches to give them the word. When I came introducing myself as someone conscious that my churches were in need of something I thought they had, they said to me, well, we see you haven't come to convert us to your style of Christianity. And so we trust you. And we want to know, will you set up some Bible lectures for our church ministers? Because that's something you have that we need. I kid you not. And I said, well, I'm not here to teach you. No, we need that. And so we worked out compromises. And to the great scandal of my seminary, I made a bargain with the principal that he would allow me to use a room in the seminary on Sunday afternoons once a month. And for the whole year that I was on the seminary campus, these independent church people would come and gather in the upstairs of this largest classroom that we had. And the students would watch them coming. You know, they couldn't believe it. I was a crazy American to them, and young at that, 25 years old. And I said, I will only offer you these Bible lectures if you will teach me how to worship, how you worship. And did they ever. Now, from that experience, I am so convinced that, I was so enriched by the contact with them. I came home so excited about Africa. I haven't done this presentation in a while, so I was in the tape room this afternoon listening to a version or two of it that I'd done 13, 15 years ago, before I knew my wife. And she was listening. She said, boy, you were even more passionate then than you are now. I said, I was closer to the experience, to the contact with those churches. I'm so convinced that God calls us into mission to be as changed as we seek to change. But that doesn't happen simply by saying, well, we should be learning from those people too, as we write the check. I am so frustrated with the instinctive response that mission to us means financial support. That the primary nature of our relationship with churches in Africa should be giving them money. I'm absolutely convinced that the kind of mission that God calls us to, of mutual transformation, requires that we not even make a move in the direction of those churches until we have first gotten very clear about what our needs are. If we don't have a sense of the limits of our own understanding of the faith, I don't think we can do good mission work. Keep in mind my story about how I had this profound sense that our understanding of the message of God's Spirit was weaker than our understanding of the Word, and that we needed help with this, and that I was looking for how I could understand that message better. We've got to have a clear sense of what our limits are, what our needs are, and go out because we think that they got an answer, maybe, for that problem that we have. And if we go out that way, anything we have to give will very naturally be taken from us. Doesn't need to be the focus of our approach. And it shouldn't be the focus within a culture that has a problem of a superiority complex. And if you don't think our culture has that, then you haven't had much contact with anybody from any other cultures. Because that's the first thing they tell us about ourselves.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Can't we really apply that same lesson here, that as we make ourselves vulnerable to people, that we have a more open communication going on, and we can hear them and they can hear us? Whereas if we come in condescendingly, they're going to be very close to us and very resentful that we set up the barriers and that attitude.
Beautiful. Absolutely true. And that's why mission doesn't just happen across national boundaries. In fact, Africans are very concerned that a lot more mission needs to start happening right within our own country, given the unchurched nature of our population. Mission and ministry, really, always require an openness to the other. Nobody likes, well, actually, I shouldn't say that. There are people who have learned to function within cycles of dependency and who will expect to come as the weak, needy person to receive whatever gifts we want to offer them. I used to have a job that involved moving around and evaluating congregationally based social service ministry programs that applied for funding. Talked about this last week in a session called Doing More Ministry with Less Money. And I've seen feeding schemes where the dependencies of the homeless or the hungry are reinforced. And I've seen feeding schemes where people are empowered. They may come in feeling and thinking pretty needy of themselves, but they go out the door with a little more self-respect than they entered. But to offer someone self-respect, you gotta have a little humility of your own, and you gotta have a respect for who they are. I mean, people who don't have self-respect can be encouraged to acquire it through the contact that we have with them. Roland Allen is a missionary who went to China in about the turn of this century, an English Anglican. The Anglicans had been working in China for 100 years at that point. He went, spent some years, he was a New Testament scholar, he spent some years working in China, then he came back home in about 1913, I think, wrote a book called Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours? He was excommunicated from the Anglican Church for that, and another book called The Spontaneous Expansion of the Church, and in parentheses, and the Forces That Hinder It. He, as a New Testament scholar, argues very, he said to his kids when he got excommunicated, don't worry, it's going to take the church 40 or 50 years to understand what I'm talking about. And today, it is common reading in our seminaries. Erdmann's has, the last I knew, had a paperback edition of both of those books out. It makes for some disturbing and inspiring reading. He says Paul's style of doing mission work was to go into a community that had virtually no orientation toward Christianity. They knew something about pagan religions and maybe something about Greek religions. They knew nothing about Christianity. And within 6 months, 5 or 6 months is as long as Paul would stay, introducing the faith to the community, baptizing some people, appointing some leaders, and then, in Allen's word, getting out of the way of the Spirit and letting the Holy Spirit do its work. Churches grew up. Roland Allen said, my church has been in China for 100 years, and if we left tomorrow, the whole operation would collapse. That's how dependent those churches have been on us. I could go on and on. In fact, I did a whole session 10 years ago, 15 years ago, on Roland Allen and how persuasive I find him to be in his critique of what is a lingering style, culture-bound, of how we do Christian mission. How many of you have been present earlier these 2 weeks when I taught this proverb, Om Tu Gumtu Gamantu? How many? Raise your hands so I can see. One, two. Will you let me teach it to the others? Thank you. That's where I'm going to close. It isn't a Christian proverb, it's an African proverb. But it's so deeply rooted in African culture that in travels among 25 countries, everywhere I went, it became a passion of mine to check out whether they were familiar with this proverb. And I have never found an African language group that isn't familiar with this proverb. So I consider it a basic understanding of Africa. Proverbs are how Africa teaches itself. To appreciate it, we might have to do a little bit of a reminder that in our culture, we all philosophically at least descend from Descartes. I think, therefore I am, remember? And that's how we become, that's the basis for our individualism. We define human nature, humanness, in terms of our individuality. So if we make a list of human rights on the board, they're all the rights of individuals. Africa has a different, not a better, but a different way of defining humanness. And it's found in this proverb, which you find all over Africa. It's the same word three times. Umtu, mumtu, the prefix ng changes the grammar. It gives it a grammatical context. It's the same word, though. And Ubuntu is simply the plural form of umtu. Person, person, people. A person is a person because of other people. So a rural Xhosa mother of five children can feed those kids by putting all the food in one bowl and with a single spoon hand it to the eldest child and say, now you share this food with your brothers and sisters happily and harmoniously, because a person is a person because of other people. And if you can't do it, then you're less than God called you to be. I'm the oldest of five children. And I can promise you that if my mother had fed us with one bowl and one spoon that got handed to me, I would have eaten better than my brothers and sisters in a culture that teaches us to look up to and respect those who got more than their share. Teaches us to go out and get as much as we can for ourselves. But maybe in a world of increasingly scarce resources, where the struggle between the haves and the have-nots is getting more and more intense and scary, and causing at least one society I know to so close its blinders that we don't even think very often about the majority corner of our Christian family, which is Africa. We still think of Christianity as basically a European and North American phenomenon. The Pew Charitable Trusts, the largest, richest foundation in this country, has decided in its religion program, and they're one of the biggest funders of religion, to devote major bucks just to help the international community begin to understand that Christianity is no longer a Western religion. It's largely a non-Western phenomenon. We are so closed to the idea that the boundaries of our baptism should take us outside of this culture. In that kind of a world, maybe there has never been a time that we are more in need of what Africa has to offer us than now. So take advantage of mission programs as a chance to claim the gifts that God wants us to receive, that our culture has somehow restricted or put blinders on us and prevented from happening, but that our baptism frees us, even if it makes us a little odd down the mountain there, to go out and get. So go get them.